First case on our calendar is 06-1616, Tammy A. Greerberger versus Laszlo Timothy, excuse me. Ms. Kelly Summers Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Kelly Summers Lawrence. I'm with the law firm of Frantz Ward in Cleveland, and I'm honored to be before you today together with my co-counsel and my father, William Summers. Together, we represent the appellant in this case, Laszlo Timothy. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents two important issues for the court's review. The first issue is whether the Ohio Civil Rights Commission, an extension of the executive branch of our government, can effectively enjoin as retaliatory the prosecution of a well-founded civil lawsuit commenced in the Common Pleas Court to recover damages incurred by an employer in its defense of claims of sexual harassment. We believe that the court should answer this question in the negative, as such actions taken by the commission violate the employer's constitutional right to have access to the courts and to petition the government for redress of grievances, and disregard the public policy of the state of Ohio in protecting the health and welfare of its citizens. The second issue in this case is whether the doctrine of estoppel should preclude a civil rights plaintiff from receiving a compensatory damage award in the form of attorney's fees when the complainant failed to list the civil rights claims as an asset in her bankruptcy schedules, listed her attorney's fees as a debt in the same schedules, had her debts discharged in the bankruptcy court, and 1 year later testified under oath before an administrative law judge that the attorney's fees remained due and owing. Under these circumstances, we respectfully urge the court to apply the doctrine of judicial estoppel to preclude Ms. Greer's recovery of a windfall damage award.
The attorney fees were an incurred obligation, were they not, or weren't they?
They were an incurred obligation. They were.
She owed them.
She owed the attorney's fees and listed them as a debt which she owed. Those fees were then discharged and no longer owed. And a year later, she actually testified before an administrative law judge, and this is in the record, that the commission, at page 24 actually of the commission's second supplement, she testified when the commission's attorney asked her, are these fees, do you still owe your attorneys these fees? Ms. Greer testified, yes, 1 year later after the debts discharged. With respect to the...
But your complaint was she didn't list the asset. What asset did she have at the time?
At the time that she filed for bankruptcy, her complaint before the Ohio Civil Rights Commission was already before the commission. The commission already found probable cause and issued a complaint. At that time, that would be considered a contingent and unliquidated asset, which is required to be scheduled on the Schedule B of her assets. She did indicate in the statement of financial affairs that she had a lawsuit. However, it wasn't listed as an asset in her schedules. And she signed those schedules under penalty of perjury, saying that they were accurate to the best of her ability. She was also represented by counsel in the bankruptcy proceedings. The Civil Rights Commission's order that Mr. Timothy cease and desist from all discriminatory practices against Ms. Greerberger effectively deprived Mr. Timothy of his constitutional rights to assert and maintain a civil action upon the alleged harm she caused him in falsely accusing him of sexual harassment. Contrary to the position of the commission here, there is no absolute right of a civil rights plaintiff to infringe upon this firmly rooted constitutional freedom, no matter how chilling the effect. Accordingly, this court should apply the holding of the United States Supreme Court in Bill Johnson's Restaurants, Inc. versus the NLRB and hold that the commission does not have the authority to enjoin the prosecution of a well-founded lawsuit unless the commission finds that the employer acted with retaliatory motive and that the suit lacks a reasonable basis in fact or law.
What is your response to the appellee's argument that the employer here had an alternative means of raising its defense, if you will, that a Civil Rule 11 pleading or, I guess, a counterclaim. What's your response to that? Neither of which was filed in this case, I understand. Is that right?
Correct. As far as the Civil Rule 11 argument or raising the issue under 2323-21 under the false claim statute, those provisions provide parties with the ability to recover attorney's fees. And in this case, Mr. Temesee is not alleging that he's entitled to attorney's fees in defending the lawsuit. He's alleging that he was emotionally and financially injured by being falsely accused of sexual harassment. Those are the allegations that he's made, and this proceeding has been enjoined so that the allegations cannot be considered as to whether there's any genuine factual issues and as to whether they have merit. As to the counterclaim issue, Mr. Temesee did not raise a counterclaim in his lawsuit. He defended his lawsuit. It went to a jury. If he would have raised a counterclaim, in my view, that would have been perhaps more suspect in terms of whether or not it was retaliatory. Instead, he waited until the proceeding concluded. It concluded in his favor, and he still was damaged. He still needed additional redress to make him whole. And that's the purpose behind asserting the emotional distress claim and asserting the abusive process claim in the civil arena. The constitutional ability to assert those claims is set forth in both the United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution, and those rights should have been protected and preserved with respect to Mr. Temesee.
He was seeking more than his attorney fees, was he not?
Correct. He was seeking compensatory and punitive damages in his civil lawsuit. And that's very similar to the fact pattern that's set forth in the Bill Johnson's case. In that case, a waitress had filed an unfair labor practice charge, and her employer went to the state court in Arizona and filed a host of civil claims, including a libel claim against the waitress. The employer asked for injunctive relief and compensatory and punitive damages. And the waitress went back to the National Labor Relations Board and filed a second unfair labor practice charge saying this is retaliatory and violates sections 8A1 and 8A4 of the National Labor Relations Act. And the board agreed with her. And the Supreme Court ultimately vacated that decision because the board made the decision without going through the exercise of determining whether the state lawsuit had a reasonable basis in fact or law, and that, and in doing that, violated the restaurant's constitutional rights.
That case had an underlying issue we don't have, though, in that it was a federal court or agency enjoining a state court. How do you answer that question in this one where we have state versus state action?
Correct. We do not have a federal aspect in this case, but what we do have is a state agency, an arm of the executive branch, that's applying the legislative law and stopping the judicial body from pursuing a case that was brought under the common law. And in that sense, it's a separation of powers issue where the executive body is coming into the judicial body and telling the judicial body, this case must be stopped without any ability to look at the case and determine whether or not the case has merit. It never got that far. Mr. Temesee filed his case, Ms. Greer-Berger filed a motion to dismiss, and two of the three claims raised were sustained on the motion to dismiss. The case never proceeded as far as summary judgment or trial because Ms. Greer-Berger then filed a motion to stay the proceedings pending a resolution of the Civil Rights Commission who enjoined Mr. Temesee from any further, quote, retaliatory practices.
What procedure did the Civil Rights Organization go through? Did they have a hearing on the merits before they determined it was retaliatory? Did he have a chance to present any evidence in that hearing before that board?
The Civil Rights Commission found that there were no issues of fact and submitted the issue on the briefs. And the findings of fact, in my view, conclude that the filing of the lawsuit in and of itself is per se retaliatory. And that seems to me to be the commission that has been urged by, the position that's been urged by the commission through the courts throughout this litigation. And what that rule does is says to employers of the state of Ohio, you will have no legal recourse for a civil rights plaintiff lodging claims against you, no matter how false or how frivolous. other than to use, in their view, the Civil Rule 11 statute and get your attorney's fees back. To the extent that you're emotionally or financially injured, to the extent that your business is crippled, you have no recourse under this per se rule, because the finding was that the filing of the lawsuit is in and of itself retaliation. In addition,
has your research shown other cases where the commission has enjoined litigants from filing lawsuits?
No.
This is the only time that you're aware?
This is the only time that I'm aware that this has occurred.
Your client argued that there was no adverse employment reaction because Greer quit her job.
Mm-hmm.
Court of Appeals didn't accept that argument. What's your response to that view?
That's correct. I think initially this case was looked at as if how could a retaliatory action come after the employment relationship has terminated and after actually the business has closed. I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court has answered that question in Burlington Northern versus White. In that case, the court made clear some case law that was relatively unclear in terms of whether or not an adverse employment action needs to be employment related. And the court said, no, it does not. However, that case is not particularly controlling of this case, because we're not just saying that it needs to be employment related to be retaliatory. We're also saying that in order for the Civil Rights Commission to stop a civil rights lawsuit in the state court, there needs to be a finding under the principles of Bill Johnson's that, one, the suit lacked retaliatory motive, and two, that there was no basis in fact or law. Frankly, we did not have the opportunity to get that far in this case. In addition, as far as the estoppel argument goes, Ms. Greer-Berger is continuing to pursue $16,000 in attorney's fees, which were awarded by the Civil Rights Commission as compensatory damages based on her representation that the fees were due and owing. Under the doctrine of judicial estoppel, Ms. Greer-Berger took a contrary position under oath in a proceeding, and the prior court, the bankruptcy court, adopted that position. For these reasons, we believe that the doctrine of judicial estoppel should preclude Ms. Greer-Berger from a recovery of attorney's fees as compensatory damages, regardless of whether or not she ultimately prevails on the retaliation claim. Thank you.
Counsel, I would like to revisit the matter about the testimony in the Civil Rights Commission on the whether the attorney fees were still owed. As I understood what you had indicated, and I may be incorrect, that she was asked if she still owed the attorney fees that she had scheduled in the bankruptcy claim.
Mm-hmm.
And her response was yes, is that correct?
That's correct. This was during testimony, and it's in the commission's supplement. This was during testimony in which Ms. Greer-Berger was claiming that the fact of the lawsuit filed by Mr. Temesi was the cause of her filing for bankruptcy. And as part of that line of testimony, the commission asked her whether or not she still owed those fees, and she answered yes.
And that would have, at the time, been legally incorrect? That they would have already been discharged at that point?
The debts had been discharged in May 2003. The hearing was in February 2004. The bankruptcy had been closed for 8 months.
Did the Civil Rights Commission ever have the accurate information before them?
I believe that Ms. Greer-Berger's attorneys in the prior case did testify that they weren't able to collect on the amount, but Ms. Greer-Berger's representation in and of itself had taken the inconsistent position that she still owed these fees.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Summers-Lawrence. Mr. Miser.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Ben Miser for the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. This court and the United States Supreme Court have repeatedly made clear, including as recently as last year in Burlington Northern, that robust anti-retaliation protections are indispensable to ensuring that employees can freely and securely exercise their statutory rights against discrimination in the workplace. Allowing a retaliatory suit such as Mr. Temesi's to go forward would eviscerate the anti-retaliation protections and indeed the anti-discrimination statute, because employees will be chilled from filing discrimination charges in the first place, because they will fear retribution by their employer in the form of a lawsuit that would be financially devastating. And indeed, here, Ms. Grierberger was literally bankrupted by Mr. Temesi's lawsuit.
Is there a middle ground to that, the position, your position and position of the employer here? You have a pro se, essentially a pro se violation or retaliatory action if the employer files any action at all. Isn't there a balancing test here that ought to be applied?
Indeed, Mr. Chief Justice, and the commission here urges a middle ground approach that is entirely consistent with the First Amendment case law by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not necessary to adopt a per se law here, where the commission found, based on reliable, probative, and substantial evidence, that Mr. Temesi's lawsuit was retaliatory. And the retaliatory nature of his lawsuit is made clear by at least three factors. The first is the face of the complaint itself. If you look at the complaint, which is found on page 34 of our Rule 7 supplement, it is clear that Mr. Temesi filed the suit because of Ms. Grierberger's lawsuit. Second, the suit was filed just 5 months after the completion of Ms. Grierberger's lawsuit, and courts in retaliation cases have made clear that the timing is critical to determining whether an employer's conduct is retaliatory. And third, the punitive damages makes especially clear how retaliatory the suit was. This court has explained in cases such as Moskovitz that compensatory damages are about compensating the plaintiff. Punitive damages are about punishing the defendant. Mr. Temesi has sought to punish Ms. Grierberger for her lawsuit.
The complaint here would have been less retaliatory if it had not requested the punitive damages.
Have been less retaliatory, but that's not to say that it would not still have been unlawful under the anti-retaliation provision. And it still would have been consistent with the First Amendment for the commission to issue a cease and desist order, because the First Amendment requires that a litigant have a prior opportunity to air his grievances in a court of law. That is what Bill Johnson's is about. In that case, the employer did not have an opportunity to air any of his grievances in court because the employee was engaging in non-judicial activities. And so the first person to walk in the court of law in that case was the employer. In this case, Ms. Grierberger was the first person to walk into court, and Mr. Temesi had ample opportunity during that underlying litigation to raise the grievances that he raises here today. He claims to have three problems with Ms. Grierberger's lawsuit that he's seeking to vindicate. One is the cost that he incurred for both attorney's fees and court costs that he seeks compensatory damages for. One is the reputational harm of a frivolous lawsuit, and one is the emotional damages that he suffered. He could have vindicated all of those interests in the underlying litigation.
How?
Opposing counsel acknowledged that he did not file a Rule 11 motion.
Rule 11 only gives you attorney fees. Rule 11 doesn't give you anything else. So how would he have vindicated his other rights?
In regard to the reputational harm that he suffered for having been frivolously accused of sexual harassment, he could have established through either a directed verdict motion, a summary judgment motion, or even a motion to dismiss under 12b-6 that the suit was indeed frivolous. Once it was completed and the jury ruled in his favor, he could also have established the frivolity of the claim through Rule 11 or through Rule 23-23.
That's still giving you directed verdict, which you can do right now as the laws exist, and still damages for only attorney fees. It gives you nothing else.
That is all that he's entitled to under the Constitution, Your Honor. The Constitution doesn't entitle him to emotional damages.
Your position really is as a per se. They have no right, no matter, I'm very sympathetic to the chilling effect. I want you to understand that. But there's part of me that tries to look at this objectively that says you are totally cutting off somebody's opportunity to recover damages if you have a truly punitive, frivolous lawsuit. Somebody wants to get someone, so they file a sexual harassment claim, and it's truly frivolous. Let's take your client's claim aside because you claim she was justified. There is no remedy other than Rule 11 in your book.
Or Rule 23-23, Your Honor, which is a statutory provision that allows fee shifting that awards attorney's fees and court costs to a party who has filed frivolous.
That's still the same thing. Basically, that's attorney fees is your only remedy under your understanding of what you think the law says.
If indeed a lawsuit has been filed by a complainant, the employer cannot file a retaliatory suit that seeks punitive damages later. That is correct, Your Honor. However, if a discriminatory charge is filed in the commission and no lawsuit has been filed by the employee, then other remedies would be available to the employer, because no one has gone into court and the employer has not yet had an opportunity to vindicate his protected First Amendment interests. But the Supreme Court in Bill Johnson's and BE&K Construction has made clear that all the petition clause requires is an opportunity to have your day in court. Mr. Tomisi had his day in court. He could have filed a whole range of motions that he chose not to file. He chose to sit on his claims, and he chose later to waltz into court and hail Ms. Gruberger into court in order to punish her.
But a claim for malicious prosecution can't be filed until a judgment is recovered in favor of the prosecuting party. So is there any precedent that you're aware of that the commission has told a citizen that they cannot file a lawsuit as a common law claim?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the commission previously having done this, but I am aware of a slew of case law that's cited in our brief in which other courts have held that the EEOC can do this and that other state civil rights commissions can do this, because retaliatory suits aren't protected by the First Amendment. And what's important to remember here
is you feel that a malicious prosecution suit is retaliatory in every instance.
Again, Your Honor, we're not urging a per se rule. In this case, Mr. Tomisi's malicious prosecution claim was actually dismissed by the Court of Common Pleas under 12b-6, so it found that it was not a well-founded claim. So we're not talking about a well-founded malicious prosecution claim here. But even if it had not been dismissed by the court.
What about a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress?
In this case, that was not something that could have been filed after the conclusion of the original lawsuit, because he had his day in court. He could have established that he was frivolously sued, and because he had that opportunity, the Constitution doesn't confer upon him a right to seek emotional damages. The Constitution ensures his right to seek a day in court. And the anti-retaliation
provision. So your view is that the ability to seek compensation of some form for frivolous conduct is the equivalent of a suit for intentional infliction of emotional distress?
It is all that the First Amendment requires in this case, Your Honor, because once a litigant has had his opportunity to raise grievances in a court of law, then the First Amendment interests are vindicated. And at that point, the strong and broadly worded anti-retaliation provision of Ohio civil rights law kicks into effect. And the statute could not be broader. Its plain language says that it shall be unlawful for any person to discriminate in any manner.
Mr. Miser, so you're saying that any lawsuit that is filed after an employee has already brought a lawsuit, any lawsuit that the employer would file would automatically be retaliatory?
No,
I mean,
Your
I think that's what I hear you saying.
No, because in this case, another important factor was that the commission made a finding that the lawsuit was indeed retaliatory. There may be instances in which a sexual harassment suit is filed, it is completed, and it terminates in the employer's favor. Some months later, the employer might be able to file a lawsuit that is not retaliatory. Perhaps it's not related to the underlying litigation. Perhaps it's clear on its face that it's related to some other tort that the employee has committed.
But
that would not be retaliatory.
But you would argue that if the employer attempted to get redress for being falsely accused, that would be retaliatory.
If the commission finds by reliable probative and substantial evidence that it was retaliatory.
But was there a hearing?
There was not an oral hearing, Your Honor. The papers were submitted by briefs, and so the commission found on the briefs that there was retaliation and then held a damages hearing.
It sounded like the commission looked at the complaint alone to make that finding of retaliatory, and that's where we get into this concern over it being a per se rule against a lawsuit altogether.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that the commission looked at papers submitted by both sides on the merits of the retaliation finding. And at the damages hearing.
Well, counsel, before you get to the damages hearing, I guess it is kind of related in some way. What about this issue of falsely representing that the $16,000 in attorney fees are due and owing when in fact they were discharged in bankruptcy?
That claim is not merit, has no merit for two reasons, Your Honor. First, Mr. Tomisi waived that argument. The revised code, section 4112.06c, says that any argument not raised before the commission cannot later be raised in the courts. Mr. Tomisi did not raise this argument before the commission or indeed before the Court of Common Pleas. He raised it for the first time in the appellate court. Even if it weren't waived, It is meritless. Mr. Temesi had ample opportunity at the damages hearing to ask Ms. Grueberger questions about her bankruptcy schedules, and indeed he did ask detailed questions about the bankruptcy schedules, but he never asked about her OCRC claim. Moreover, the OCRC claim was in fact listed on, it can be found on page 87 of our Rule 7 supplement under the Statement of Financial Affairs. So she did not mislead the bankruptcy court, and she did not mislead the ALJ. She testified that indeed she had not paid her attorneys, but her bankruptcy estate still owed the fees to the attorneys, who testified also at the damages hearing.
Wait a minute, her bankrupt estate still owed the attorney fees, but weren't these attorney fees discharged in bankruptcy 100%?
They are, Your Honor, but if Mr. Temesi...
So she doesn't owe any attorney, $16,000.
If Mr. Temesi is indeed made to pay the attorney's fees, they will flow to the bankruptcy estate, and the bankruptcy trustee will then distribute the fees in accordance with federal bankruptcy law. But the issues of federal bankruptcy...
So you can reopen the bankruptcy to do that? You're sure of that?
The federal bankruptcy trustee will distribute the fees in accordance with federal law. But that is not an issue before this court. The issue before this court is, first, that Mr. Temesi has clearly waived this argument, and second, that judicial estoppel is an extreme remedy that is only available when a party has perverted the judicial process and intentionally misled the courts. Ms. Grueberger did not intentionally mislead the courts. She was correct that she never paid her lawyers. She was correct in listing on her bankruptcy schedule that she had filed an OCRC charge, and that was listed on her statement of financial affairs.
So you dispute that she said at the hearing that she still owed this money?
I don't dispute that she said that, but that is not to say that she intentionally misled the ALJ, which is what is required for judicial estoppel. Even if Mr. Temesi has not waived this argument, she did not pervert the judicial process. Her attorneys testified that they had never been paid. And again, Your Honor, the issue here is whether the extreme remedy of judicial estoppel is warranted. And she did not pervert the judicial process. Her attorneys never got paid. And that's a matter for the bankruptcy trustee, not for this court.
Did the commission know that the attorney fees had been discharged by the bankruptcy court?
The ALJ heard testimony by Ms. Grueberger's lawyer from the underlying litigation.
Yes.
That lawyer testified that indeed the attorney's fees had been discharged in bankruptcy, but that they had never been paid to the lawyer.
I wasn't sure what your answer was to Justice O'Connor's question about whether you can represent to us that the bankruptcy court can reopen the case if assets become available.
If assets from a prior existing obligation become available, they go to the bankruptcy trustee. The bankruptcy trustee then distributes the funds in accordance with federal law. I'm not a bankruptcy expert. I can't tell you how the bankruptcy
case is closed, as I understand from all the documents. So the question really is whether it can be reopened.
It would be reopened if a prior existing financial obligation flows to the bankruptcy estate. But again, I would reiterate that Mr. Temesi waived this argument. He never raised this argument, and the statute says that an argument not raised before the commission cannot be raised before this court or any other court, and he didn't raise this issue until the Court of Appeals. So both the statute and this court's case law, which say that an argument not raised before an administrative body is waived, make clear that Mr. Temesi can't be heard to raise this argument here today. In closing, I would just like to reiterate that Mr. Temesi's First Amendment interests could have been fully vindicated in the underlying litigation because he had the opportunity to establish, if indeed he's correct, that Ms. Grueberger's lawsuit was frivolous. The First Amendment does not entitle him to a second bite at the apple, and it certainly doesn't entitle him to seek punitive damages in a way that would eviscerate the anti-discrimination statute and the broadly worded anti-retaliation provision of the statute. Because his suit was so punitive, the commission was entirely entitled to issue a cease and desist order and put an end to litigation like his. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miser. Ms. Summers Lawrence, you've saved just about a minute and a half of your time.
Counsel, could you address the punitive damage claim in regard to whether that makes the claim a retaliatory lawsuit?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that this is squarely addressed by the United States Supreme Court in the Bill Johnson's case. What the Supreme Court looked at is whether the litigant has a right to fully vindicate his or her claims in court, and that includes even in the Bill Johnson's case, raising punitive damages or compensatory damages. There is no precedent that I know of that says you can file a lawsuit, but you can only get your attorney's fees, or you can only get compensatory damages. Otherwise, once you ask for punitive damages, that's retaliatory. What the Bill Johnson's court said, recognizing the chilling effect that this might have on individuals who attempt to organize a union and exercise their rights to concerted activity.
Well, is but that it the question of whether a suit is retaliatory or not is a subjective conclusion, is it not? Someone has to decide whether this is retaliatory. And why isn't the request for punitive damages an indicator that I'm really mad at you because you filed a suit against me or because you did something that's caused me embarrassment? I want punitive damages for that. Why could that not be an indicator of retaliation?
If I could answer your question briefly, the request for punitive damages cannot be in and of itself anything more than what it is, a request for legally recognized relief. However, if these claims are adjudicated and if it is found that there are no genuine issues of material fact, that the claims lack a reasonable basis in fact in law, and the claims are in fact retaliatory, which in this case we did not have. We had the commission who submitted the matter based upon the facts that were agreed upon, which was that a lawsuit had been filed after the prior suit finished in a jury verdict. Under these facts, we weren't even able to get into and to make that subjective determination. And under Bill Johnson's, even if there is a determination as to retaliatory conduct, there also needs to be a determination that the civil lawsuit lacks a reasonable basis in fact or law. Otherwise, the constitutional right to litigate and effectively litigate a dispute before either a jury or a judge is part of the constitutional freedoms, and the state has a right to protect the public health and safety of all citizens, employers and employers alike. For these reasons, we respectfully ask that you vacate the judgment of the court below and remand the cease and desist order, and also invoke the doctrine of judicial estoppel to preclude Ms. Gerberger from receiving a windfall damage award.
Thank you, Ms. Summers. Well, Lawrence, the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.